Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Gattaca. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, but if you do listen without having seen it, just be aware there may be spoilers. Enjoy.
Oh, hello there.
Central Park in Newark.
How are you today?
I'm good, man. I'm good. You were talking to me earlier about Newark, not the town in New Jersey where the airport is. And it reminded me of Flight of the Conchords thing. And then I was just ended up down a rabbit hole of watching Flight of the Conchords clips and reminded me that was just a very good show.
I've not watched that in years. I think it was when I was still at university or maybe just afterwards.
We used to have the DVD. I just edited the What Happens in Vegas episode. So now I'm going to be like two episodes behind on the edits. But that one was where we talked about DVDs loads. And then I remember that we used to have that one on DVD as well. The box set. We had so many box sets.
Me and my partner, we did a road trip down to Cornwall. And one of the things that we did was put in the CD to the radio show of Flight of the Conchords.
Oh, nice.
On the way down. And that was very funny to listen to in the car. To make a difference from listening to music.
Yeah, music. Boring. Music's for nerds.
You know what's not for nerds? Listening to comedy.
No, you should only ever listen to men talking. They say, recording this the day before International Women's Day.
I was going to say, perfect timing.
But this won't come out for another 3 weeks, probably, knowing my schedule.
And by that point, everyone will have forgotten about trying to challenge misogyny and the patriarchy, because the day's over.
Yeah, that's how it works. It'll be back to TikToks and Skibbity Toilet, as I said on that other episode.
I thought you were a dad, not a granddad, complaining about TikToks all day.
I know. No, I'm like a great granddad. The pace of everything these days just makes me feel so ancient.
Back in my day, we didn't have the internet, etc.
Back in my day, it was dial-up.
Speaking of back in my day, EA, right, Electronic Arts. Not the best company in the world, I think it's fair to say. Pretty rubbish. They have just released a load of classic games onto Steam.
Really?
That previously weren't on any libraries or were only available via the EA app, which is the worst of all of the digital storefronts for video games.
There's an EA app.
Yeah, so you know Steam.
Yeah.
And you know the Epic Store.
Oh, yeah. I've heard tell of the Epic Store. Obviously, I'm purely a Nintendo man, so all of this stuff feels like, yeah, it's alien to me. No, I do have Steam, but on the computer that can't run that well. So it wouldn't be able to play anything like anything impressive. But
well, it can now run a selection of EA games that are available, such as the Command & Conquer Collection, including the original Command & Conquer games. Populous and the other Populous games, if you remember them.
Never played those.
World building game. SimCity 3000. For some reason, SimCity 2000. It's not made available, but 3000 was good as well.
I played that. Yeah.
Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri, which is a great game.
A jumble of words to me.
It's like a strategy game where you're settlers on a planet in space. Okay. It's fun. And the Dungeon Keeper games. So, yeah, if you wanted to pick up Dungeon Keeper for £2 or SimCity 3000 for £1.71, which I'm probably going to do, and then it's just going to sit in my game library because now I have a baby, I can't sit at a desktop computer to play a video game anymore.
I mean, people do, don't they? But you shouldn't.
I'm thinking, like, eventually I'm going to have a PC game to review at some point. The games I've picked up since the baby's arrived have all been PS5, so I can sit on the sofa with her. But eventually I'm going to get a PC game, and then I guess I'm just going to have to put her in a little in the carrier on me.
Mm-hmm. Standing up. Which is kind of a baller move, actually. I feel like there's a power play almost. Gaming standing up.
I think that could work.
It's like one of those, you'd be one of those standing desk people.
Exactly, but for gaming. Or maybe putting my chair into full recline with her in the carrier and then just sort of leaning forwards to the mouse. That might work as well.
I remember when my youngest son was a baby, but I wouldn't game on the TV, but I'd had the Switch in handheld mode. I'd be like sort of cradling him while he was sleeping, or like trying to get to sleep and playing Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. That was the game of the day.
Yeah. That is exactly what I've been doing with either the Switch or the Steam Deck. So whenever she's asleep on me, I'm either watching the X-Files, I have played games on the PS5 for review, or it is FIFA or the F1 games, or basically anything where I don't have to pay much attention to it. I could never do something like Bloodstained, where you have to rely on actual like reflexes, because I know the F1 games so well by now, because I'm such a geek, that basically all the tracks are muscle memory. So I don't actually have to pay that much attention. It's almost like mindfulness going round. Here we go.
You should make like meditation videos of that going, oh, it's Rob. Here we go around Brands Hatch again.
Yeah, I should do one for Tokatu Touring Cars. Here we are taking a nice drive around Thruxton. The average lap time will be 1 minute and 8 seconds.
I could do you some nice music for it.
Yeah, that would be
lo-fi versions of the horrible music that's on Tokatu Touring Cars.
Fuck off, mate. Genuinely, criticize Tokatu Touring Cars all you like. I know that you have terrible taste in video games, but the music is impeccable. It has got this incredible breakbeat soundtrack.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Genuinely, the soundtrack to Tokatu is something I will not stand for the bad name of Tokatu Touring Cars soundtrack to be bad mouthed. The best video game soundtrack of all time. It's well good. Well good. You could actually put it on in a club and dance to it.
Which we should do.
Yeah, where's my Tokatu Touring Car club night?
That's your club night, that is.
Codemasters, I know you're listening. Put on a club night at your studios.
Yeah.
Just let people in, have a rave, and just put on... You could put on all your soundtracks to your new rubbish games. Or
in one room.
Or you could just have the Tokatu Touring Car soundtrack playing over and over and over again.
That genuinely sounds really cool.
Yeah, I should do it.
Video game music club night. Has that ever been done?
It must have been done, but like with cucks listening to the Sonic soundtrack instead of listening to music. The Sonic soundtracks are good, right?
You could dance to those.
Yeah, but they're not club music.
Well, like, I think my remix of the Hydro City Zone versus Sure Shot by the Beastie Boys begs to differ. You could drop that at a hip-hop club night and the place would go off, I'm telling you.
Not as well as your tub-thumping Galway girl.
Still my best work, obviously.
But yeah, I'm not one of those people that's often, yeah, it's good for a video game. But there are two things about that. One is storyline good for a video game, I'm fully on board with, because most video game stories are rubbish.
Yeah.
So when people say like, oh, the story is good for a video game, it's like, yeah, okay, I understand that. It's not as good as if you're reading it in a book. And also the music as well is, video game music is good, but it's good for video games. So when you get these people that are like, oh yeah, I'm gonna listen to fucking Super Mario World soundtrack and pump some iron, why? Listen, there are two video game soundtracks that you can pump iron to, one of which is Tokatu Touring Cars, the perfect soundtrack for any given moment of your life, and the other is the Doom 2016 soundtrack, which is perfect music for that game.
Well, I'm not saying I pump iron to it, but you know I'm in the top like 0.1% of listeners of Castlevania Sound Team on Spotify, so you may be talking to the wrong person about this.
You are just a Castlevania music man.
Yeah,
that's
true. And there are some other soundtracks I genuinely listen to when I'm walking around or commuting or whatever.
Shovel
Knight is one of them.
Yeah,
the Messenger is another one. A lot of the 8-bit ones.
You should listen to the music from Sea of Stars.
You should play
Sea of Stars.
I know, I'm saving it. I've played the demo. The demo was awesome.
It's a very good game.
And I'm waiting to buy it When I next get paid, I think, because I want the physical edition that's coming out.
Oh, you want the physical one?
Yes, but I've purposefully not listened to any of the music other than what is in the demo, because I know I'm going to love it so much that I want to experience it in-game rather than spoiling it, spoiling the in-game experience of it, if that makes sense.
That's what I say to that.
Because I love him so much and I know his music is really, really good.
Who is it?
Eric W. Brown, a.k.a. Rainbow Dragon Eyes. So he went under his real name for Sea of Stars, but in The Messenger, he was known as Rainbow Dragon Eyes. I think the guys from the studio like found him. He makes like chiptune metal, which is so good, and I love it. I think the guys from the studio found him and like said, "Will you come and do this music for our game?" And then he became like a full time member of the studio. But he's also the drummer in the band Necrogoblicon. You heard of them?
That sounds familiar. Are they the metal band with a little goblin man?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so he plays drums in that band as well. So right, just an all-round really cool dude. But yeah, I'm saving the Sea of Stars soundtrack to experience it in-game. A bit like how, you know, some people will never listen to the soundtrack of a musical before they go and see it, right? It's not quite the same thing, but you know what I mean? Like with Hamilton, I listened to it before I went to see the show because it was such a phenomenon. But if you'd gone to see it, like my wife hadn't heard it, and then when we went to see it, she was just like blown away, got to experience it in that way for the first time, and then I didn't. I want to have that kind of experience with it.
I have not seen Hamilton, and I don't know if I've ever willingly listened to an entire song of Hamilton.
It's good.
Which I should do.
We could talk about it. It's on the recording of it's on Disney Plus. I mean, it's very long.
I know, but then I'd have to watch a musical.
You don't have to. You don't have time for that.
I do not have time for musicals. The one thing I would say is that obviously David Diggs was in it, and I like him.
He is very good.
Clipping is a band I really love. I don't know if you know much Clipping.
Bits and pieces, yeah.
Just weird experimental hip hop. That's my thing because I'm a white man. Yeah. I'm a pretentious white man, so I love my experimental hip hop. Clipping are amazing, and he's amazing. We should talk about his movie as well at some point, Blindspotting.
I haven't seen that.
It's just really cool.
But I have seen a lot of episodes of Sesame Street in which he plays Mr. Noodle. So
who's to say?
Yeah.
He's in Velvet Buzzsaw as well, which is a cool film.
Is that a horror film?
Sort of. It's like a comedy horror. It was directed by this guy called Dan Gilroy, who did a great movie called Nightcrawler, where Jake Gyllenhaal is one of those people who goes around filming really violent stuff that can then be shown on local TV.
Oh, right.
And it's sort of got that... it's got that sort of Taxi Driver, American Psycho, Fight Club vibe to it, of like the seedy underbelly of horrible human beings.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant film. And then his follow up was a movie called Velvet Buzzsaw, which is all about art and art critics. And I think there's like a murderous painting or something. I can't remember now. It's been years since I haven't watched it since it came out. And that was like 5 years ago. But it's very good. Apart from Jake Gyllenhaal's character is basically, you know, in Always Sunny, where Frank pretends to be an art critic in that one episode.
Yeah.
It's basically that.
That sounds great.
Yeah. It's a really funny movie. Very sharp witted. I'm a big fan. Big fan of it.
That sounds really good.
Anyway, I did have an amazing segue for this week's movie a bit ago, but we kind of talked further. Talking about amazing...
What was the segue?
Talking
I'll pretend
about...
there are, never happened to all of our chat.
Talking about amazing soundtracks, which I listen to outside of the original work, Gattaca. Gattaca soundtrack.
Do you sometimes just pop on the Gattaca soundtrack?
Genuinely, I have it, or at least I had it.
Sway around your house.
I genuinely either have it or had it on CD.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I love the music. Michael Nyman did the soundtrack to this film. And the main refrain score piece that repeats throughout the film is one of my favorite pieces of music ever.
Yeah, it's incredible. And it comes back at all the right moments.
Yeah.
This film score is amazing. And it elevates it from a good film to a great one,
I'd
say.
Yeah, I'd agree. But I like Gattaca a lot. Did you enjoy Gattaca?
I did. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it's a funny one, isn't it? Because it's not necessarily talked about that much anymore, is it? Like, you don't hear people saying, "Oh, remember Gattaca?"
No, it's
really, really good, and it might have a few flaws, but I was really pleasantly surprised by it and sort of nostalgic for it. I remember seeing it when I was like 15, maybe, and thinking it was really like a really great film, and not understanding why it wasn't like a massive phenomenon.
Yeah, and that's the thing, isn't it? Is that it is like a cult classic, Gattaca, but maybe one that people don't talk about that much. Isn't on any streaming services at the moment except ITVX.
It's on Amazon Prime.
No, I looked on Amazon. I had to pay for it.
So I did as well. But then it was on there twice, once to pay and once free.
Are you kidding me? So I had to watch bloody adverts on ITVX for no reason. I mean, luckily, I literally pay no attention to adverts at all. But yeah, oh, that's really irritating because I looked on there and it came up as rent or buy. I didn't even see it on the page when I searched Gattaca that there was another.
Do you have an Apple device?
I have a Mac.
Oh, I don't know if you can do it on desktop, but on your phone, if you go to Apple TV and search for something, it aggregates all of the apps on your phone and searches them. So that's how I was able to do that.
Okay.
It's the only thing Apple have ever done that is any good.
The only thing they've ever done. Anyway, you mentioned this not being a big success, which is true. This is a big old bomb.
Was it?
Cost $36 million to make. So not a lot of money to make. Made $12.5 million back in the US. Didn't do great, but it's become a cult classic. I think a lot of people picked it up on Blu-ray or DVD. And
I saw this at school. We had it on a VHS.
It
was
VHS.
Like one of our cool teachers had it, if that makes sense.
Right?
And it was weekend movie night. You know, I went to boarding school. Sometimes we'd stay over in the weekend and like this was a Saturday night movie that a bunch of us watched. I'm like, wow, this is incredible.
Very good. Very good. And it was well loved by critics. So I think the people who watched it really liked it, but not enough people went to go and see it. It came in number 5 at the box office on its first, when it opened. Right. Behind I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Okay.
The Devil's Advocate, Kiss the Girls, and 7 Years in Tibet.
7 Years in Tibet.
So that's the biographical movie about a bloke who goes off to Tibet.
Oh, right, yeah, that guy.
Brad Pitt, the movie.
The Tibet guy. Oh, yeah, Brad Tibet.
Brad Tibet, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've never seen it because it sounds really boring. It's a biographical movie about people in the past. Why am I watching that when I could be watching I Know What You Did Last Summer and watching someone get killed with a meat hook?
Yeah.
I love I Know.
Girls. That's a Morgan Freeman one, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. So that's based on a it's one of the 70 / Silence of the Lambsy serial killer movies that came out around that time, based on a James Patterson novel.
Oh, right, yeah.
But yeah, I love the I Know What You Did Last Summer movies, by the way.
Yeah, I've only seen the first one. I thought it was all right.
There was then I Still Know What You Did Last Summer, which has Jack Black in it.
Oh, yeah.
He plays a wannabe white Rastafarian.
Oh, no.
It's great. I think it's Jack Black. It's been years since I watched it. Yeah, I think it's him. I think it's him. I might have to look that up.
But yeah, the titles of all of those get progressively sillier as they go along, don't they?
I think there's then I'll Always Know What You Did Last Summer, but I don't think that got released in cinemas.
And,
and I don't think any of the original cast came back for it. Yeah, whereas the first two sort of have something to do with one another. They're not good. They're not good movies, but they are fun.
No. I'm somehow looking at the soundtrack from the first one. It's incredibly 90s. Cooler Shaker, Offspring, L7.
L7.
Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Speaking of bad band Corn, names.
That is one of the all-time worst ones, isn't it? Toad the Wet Sprocket.
Yeah.
I'm sure it means something really meaningful, but
I have no interest in finding out. Apparently, they are doing a legacy sequel for I Know What You Did Last Summer, like with the Scream movies, where they're going to bring it all back and have people back in to reprise their roles.
What's a legacy sequel? Is that when you've got the original cast back to do something?
Yeah, so when you basically sort of it's a big break in time, and then you bring back the original cast, even if it's like sometimes it's sort of there as sort of cameos to help bed in a new cast of people to be the new leads, that kind of thing.
Right. So when Gattaca 2 comes out, Big Boys
Productions. Yeah, when Gattaca 2 comes out,
Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman can come back. And they're married in real life. That's a funny
not
thing, isn't
anymore.
It? Not anymore.
No, I don't.
Oh no,
think
you're right.
So.
Not since 2005. Okay.
All right, old man Johnson.
Oh, they were, but at the time of filming this film, potentially it says.
Yeah, so this is where they met, I believe.
Right, and you really dating. Feel the chemistry between them, don't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. They really get this sense. What I like about this movie, but there's lots of things I like about this movie. You know, the weird brutalist architecture, which is a big focus of it. The sort of dreamlike way that it weaves around and how that ties into the score. But the main thing that I really like is how it basically feels like a 1940s or 1950s movie.
Yeah.
And nowhere is that more true than with the chemistry and relationship between the two leads here.
And it becomes more and more like that as it goes on, which is really amazing. It's and at first it's jarring. And I'd forgotten about this from the first time I watched it. My memory of it was just that being this kind of really clever, intense, very, you know, aesthetically heavy and stylized like sci-fi film, but with real depth, but also with bags of piss in the fridge and stuff. So you know, that's, when you're 15, that's the kind of thing that you love. Bags so we could do this one for Piss Month, but obviously we've done it now already. But
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but then it's sort of, you think it's about him wanting to go into space, right? It spends the first 40 minutes or so on his kind of like, I want to beat this eugenics nonsense and go into space. And then it turns into a kind of 1940s, it's almost film noir-y romance thing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's really incredible how it does that about face, even though it is kind of jarring.
Yeah, it does that shift into murder mystery, although the murder never really matters. What matters is his
Gore Vidal did it.
Clues in the name.
Gore.
Loves the gore.
Yeah.
Anyway, what was I talking about?
Gore Vidal.
Oh yeah, so it doesn't really matter who does the murder. That's not the point. The point is him trying to then evade detection. But it has this sort of noir-esque quality with this smoky romance between the two of them. But what's interesting, of course, is that it is kind of an inversion of the traditional tropes of the noir, where sometimes you have the deceptive femme fatale who is the one who has the secrets. However, this time around, we're on the side of the person who is keeping those secrets from someone who is quite upfront at all times about their situation.
Yeah.
And I thought that was quite an interesting way to play it as well.
Absolutely. You think it's about what it appears to be about on the surface, right? About eugenics and genetics and all that kind of stuff. But that's just the dystopian backdrop for actually like a character study.
Yeah.
And what people perceive as their destiny and sort of overcoming fate and those kinds of things. And it's really, really clever the way it sort of very, very gradually turns the screws on those themes, I'd say.
Yeah, it's smart. And the way that ties into the wider piece of eugenics, I think, is very clever.
Yeah.
In the way that everybody's destiny is tied back to this oppressive world that they live in. That you have Ethan Hawke, who... he has this ambition, he has this drive and this desire to be something great, which is denied him because of who he was when he was born. Then you've got Uma Thurman, who is facing similar but not as severe struggles, and is trying to do things by the book to try and achieve the same goals, as opposed to completely denying the state of the world and overcoming it. She's trying to play around it. And then you've got Jude Law as the third of the three main parties in the film, as someone who had all of that privilege but had it taken away from him, and how he then reacts to it. Although, of course, we eventually realise that in spite of the physical perceived perfection of his form, instead, actually, that didn't stop things like mental ill health from manifesting in him, even though they tried to deny its existence.
Yeah, which you kind of saw that coming a bit more than some of the stuff about his perceptions of his destiny. But it's a great performance of Jude Law. I think it's the first thing that one of the first things I ever saw him in.
Yeah, I think it was the same for me as well. I think this was the first thing I saw Jude Law in. It was this in Existence.
I don't think I ever saw that.
Oh, we should talk about Existence at some point. We could do a Cronenberg month, the perfect director for a romantic movie podcast. Existence is basically Videodrome, but video games.
Right.
That's basically what it is. And it's him and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh, okay.
Where they go into this virtual reality game, and it's very odd. And they make a gun out of fish bones. That's the thing I remember. and the thing that they use to... tune into the reality game looks like a weird sort of organ, and it moans and makes sexy noises when they turn it on and things. It's very odd and David Cronenberg-y, as you might expect. Yeah, it's very good film. I think it's one of his underrated ones. I think because it's so similar to Videodrome in its setup, people kind of ignored it, whereas in reality it's actually a very clever little movie. But yeah, I think those were the two things that I saw Jude Law in first, and he is fantastic in it. In fact, I think everybody in this movie is very good and builds into this weird 40s/50s, which also makes sense from an architecture perspective, of course, because it's all brutalistic. So we're looking at 50s again there.
Yeah, but it does still feel futuristic as well, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's not explicit about its setting, but and that's the amazing thing about it. It feels so futuristic and so far removed from the time in the 90s, and even from now. Look, it's jarring to watch, but it's actually shot in buildings that exist. You know, everything in it was very, very real, wasn't it, at the same time? And I thought that's an amazing thing to be able to pull that off, to give a sense of a distant, futuristic, dystopian place without using... I mean, I don't think there was any CGI, was there, really?
No, I guess only for some of the rockets.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's it.
Without feeling the need to show you loads of futuristic guff. I mean, there was computers stuff, wasn't there, that were making stuff happen. There's one bit where he's like, so he's rolling around, he's swinging around in that big ball thing in the gym. But like, but that was kind of it, really, wasn't it?
And that big ball thing in the gym, I think they do use those for astronaut training anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, it is interesting the way that they do it. And it does create this sense of a future that may exist or maybe is down a different pathway to where we are now, where that kind of architecture is in place. And equally, there's just those little moments where you see things and you're like, yeah, this is definitely not our time. For instance, at the end, when they're doing their flight to Titan, they're all just sitting in comfy chairs on the rocket. And you're just like, oh yeah, so they're just sitting there. They're not even having to wear spacesuits or anything. And it's those little moments like that where you do realize, okay, yeah, this is a future that could exist.
I love that. And as you say, the budget is still relatively low for what it is. Most of that probably went on paying these very good actors.
Yeah.
36 million. I mean, that's still a lot more in 1997 money than it is in today's money. But like, it really, really is a masterclass in, I think, less is more, and showing, giving that sense of place through colour and architecture and atmosphere rather than a bunch of flashy nonsense. And I think that perhaps that's part of the reason why people didn't really latch onto it, is because it's not that easy to get into, is it? Even though I think it's really engaging from the word go, people maybe look at it expecting it to be like, well, this is an anachronism, but like Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets or something like that. You know, just the first kind of ridiculous sci-fi film that came to mind. You know, maybe people want it to be like that.
Michael Bay's Gattaca. Yeah. Which is, what's that movie he made with the clones?
Attack of the Clones. Attack of the Clones. Michael Bay clones.
He did.
The
he did
Island.
Like the Island.
Yes, I've seen that. Yeah.
That's it. That's basically what his version of this would be.
Yeah,
that's rubbish, something that's always annoyed me, right, is the way that they clearly ripped off Michael Marshall Smith's novel Spares for the island. Blatant ripoff. So much so that I believe they might have optioned. This might be something that I read that isn't true, so take it with a pinch of salt, but I swear that somebody optioned the rights to Spares.
I've got it. I'm on the page now. It says here, Michael Marshall Smith's 1996 novel Spares, in which the hero liberates intelligent clones from a spare farm, was optioned by DreamWorks in the 1990s, but was never made. Never made. It remains unclear if the story inspired the island, and so Marshall Smith did not consider it worthwhile to pursue legal action over the similarities.
So look, all I'm going to say about that is they optioned the novel Spares to make an adaptation. That then expired. And then DreamWorks in 2005 made the movie The Island about clones escaping from a clone facility where their organs are used for rich people in the world outside, which is the plot summary of the book Spares.
Yeah. Michael Marshall Smith just couldn't be asked.
It's exactly. A writer.
This film sucks. It's going to go away. Who cares?
Yeah, it's a writer going up against an institution like DreamWorks. I think he probably thought to himself, yeah, maybe it's not worth it. All it's going to do is lose me money.
He didn't want to end up with DreamWorks face.
Yeah, that's what happens if you lose. I wonder what he's writing next, Michael Marshall Smith. I loved his books.
Yeah.
Only Forward, Spares, and One of Us. Three wonderful sci-fi novels, if anyone is interested in reading them. Also then did some great short stories under that name as well. And then wrote a load of thrillers under the name Michael Marshall. And then he's done some other thrillers under a different name. He's got a million pseudonyms.
He's done a lot.
Yeah.
It's something that pops up on like sort of Fantasy Society Awards, Sci-Fi Awards, those kind of things. Yeah, British Fantasy Society won a bunch of their awards.
Yeah, he's a really good writer. I love his stuff. But I've not. Yeah, I wonder what he's up to. The problem is, of course, because he's got so many pseudonyms, it's hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
of what his next book is.
It's like a Tory MP.
Exactly. How do we get onto this? Oh yeah, Michael Bay's Gattaca. Yeah.
Is that versions of Gattaca that are rubbish, but that did much better at the box office.
And instead, this is a slow, methodical, thoughtful movie that's character driven, where there are no explosions. There's only one bit of excitement where he punches a cop. That's basically it. You can understand.
Like one punch.
You can understand why people maybe didn't flock to see this movie. It is a very thoughtful film.
That's the amazing thing about it, actually, now that you mention it. The exact sort of climactic moment of it is when the doctor guy reveals that he's kind of known all along that he's a fake.
Yeah.
And he just kind of says two sentences to him and then walks off. And Ethan Hawke just kind of sits there. And that's it. That's the big bomb of the whole film. But it's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a couple of these incredible moments there, which on the face of it don't seem to be worth much if you just were to describe them to someone. Because the other one is man goes for a swimming competition with his brother.
Yeah.
and those are the two bits in this movie where you feel this real tension and this real power behind it.
Which happens twice.
And genuinely, if you were just going to explain this movie to people like that, they would just not, there would be zero interest in it. But instead, it's just the way that it's framed, the way that it's directed. The script works perfectly for this film, but maybe wouldn't work if you took it out of context. Because I was looking through some quotes to share, and they just sound so stupid. out of context of this pseudo 1950s noir, but in the future setup of it. It's a great little film, really unique, nothing else like it. Unfortunately, bless Andrew Niccol, nothing he's directed since has really competed either.
This was his debut.
He then wrote The Truman Show, which is a Have we talked about the Truman Show yet?
I feel like we have, but I'm going to have to double check.
If we haven't, we really should talk about the Truman Show sometime.
I definitely know that we've double checked whether we've talked about it before. Again, Statler and Waldorf over here.
But then nothing else he's really touched has... nothing else he's made has really touched Gattaca in terms of that impact.
I don't know what you mean about 2013's The Host, an adaptation of Stephanie Meyer's novel.
Oh, yeah, he did the other Stephanie Meyer book, didn't he?
I've not seen it.
I've heard good things about some of his films that I've not seen. Like, I've heard good things about Good Kill, which is the one about drone pilots. With it, him reuniting with Ethan Hawke, for instance.
Oh. We have not done The Truman Show. Should
we do The Truman Show next?
Well, I have an idea.
Ah, okay.
To bring up, but I'll give you the choice.
Remind me of The Truman Show next time, then. I don't want to impede on.
Yeah, yeah.
On your idea. But yeah, and yeah, like, he's made good movies. Lord of War is a surprisingly good film, given that it's about Nicolas Cage being an arms dealer in the mid-2000s. That just sounds like it's going to be a disaster, but it's actually rather good. But nothing else has done what Gattaca has done. So maybe this I, Object movie that we talked about last week will be that one that does it.
It does look cool, doesn't it?
Yeah, the weird sort of live action / animation thing going on. Always a fan of those kind of weird things.
With Jermaine Clement in it. There we go. Yeah. There's a link back to Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah, so, you know. Maybe that'll be another... maybe that'll be a good one. But yeah, no, Gattaca is just this standalone work of art that nothing else quite has matched. But
even
it's not perfect.
He never made anything else, like, it would be enough.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I will say, though, it's not perfect.
No, I think it sort of sags in the middle a bit, doesn't it? And the relentless sort of darkness of the colour palette and the aesthetic does sort of... it makes it a little bit drab at times.
I disagree. I love that bit. But I will say that it does drag in the middle. I do think sometimes the dialogue doesn't quite hit the mark. And it feels a bit like someone pretending too much to be a noir rather than actually getting the audience to actually fully get on board with it as this noir pastiche. It feels a little bit too fake. And one thing that I've always found a bit frustrating about this movie is the focus of its eugenics, where we know that eugenics is a load of old shit, right?
Yeah.
Like, just obviously dog shit. Yet in this movie, there's even a line of dialogue, which on the face of it is a very clever line, and it could have been a very clever line if they'd gone down to the full root of it, which is, we have discrimination down to a science.
Yeah. It now, didn't do enough with that side of it, did it? It really reopened that box and didn't explore it enough, did it? Because it was too busy doing its film noir-esque thing.
And the film noir-esque stuff is brilliant, but I think there just needed to be a few snippets here and there to help embed the idea that actually this isn't based in science, right? And this won't supplant the existing prejudice and discrimination in society. It's only going to embolden it. So, like, this is only going to amplify racism. This isn't going to replace racism.
Yeah. There's a bit where he's doing his kind of intro monologue and talking through his life, which I actually think works really well as a setup. Yeah. That whole thing is an amazing, like, let's sowing the seeds for the film. But he talks about how discrimination is technically illegal, but that everyone does it anyway. And then it doesn't do anything with that either.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is there's all of these elements that it really could have built on. And actually there's an allegory here for racism, for ableism in particular, they really could have leaned on. But they never go into that in enough detail, I think, for what it could have been. I think this could have been an absolute masterpiece instead of just being a movie that's a cult classic sort of masterpiece.
Yeah. And if they explored that a bit more, and if you did actually get to see him running around on Titan fulfilling his dream.
I think we definitely needed more space. We needed him in a wearing a jetpack on Titan going woo and flying about. That should have been the last minute of the movie. Just
would have made him so happy, you know. I want to see our boy happy.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I do think, yeah, there's more room here to explore the thematic elements of what the setting could have represented if they weren't too busy on the noir-esque elements. And maybe they could have shifted the attention a little bit. Didn't need to be too much. They could even have had something as subtle as, well, look at all of these people who are the underclass now. Interesting how all of them are people of colour, isn't it? And interesting about how it's only... We're talking about America here, right? So the only people that are going to have kids who are completely devoid of any kind of congenital disorder are going to be rich people.
Yeah.
They don't explore that either, because Vincent himself comes from a poor family. His brother also comes from a poor family, but has all of these things, all of these benefits. And so they could have explored classism, they could have explored ableism, they could have explored racism. All of those elements were right there, ready to be picked out, and they didn't do anything with them, which I think
you don't get much of a sense of how Gattaca's economy functions, do you?
Yeah, I want to know about the trade disputes of Star Wars Episode 1 in Gattaca. Thank you very much.
The opening crawl, yeah.
they could have taken all of that out of Star Wars Episode 1 and put it in here, and I think that could have expanded it a lot more.
Ethan Hawke running down the corridor to tell the Viceroy that the Gattaca will no longer trade with Naboo.
Yeah, he's off to Naboo, not to Titan.
But you know what I mean? There's so much like unexplored depth.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing in a way, because they've created a really interesting world where, you know, if you think that is kind of a good thing. It means that what they've come up with is interesting. But it's like sometimes it's a really difficult balance to strike with writing, isn't it? Because you don't want to get too bogged down in world building because you're ultimately there to tell a story. But if there's parts of the world that are left unexplored that could be really good, then sometimes, you just feel like it's a missed opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I think... That's the thing. If you bring up something like transhumanism, then you can't just leave that there to go off and do something else. You need to really focus on what that means. And this is something that a lot of things get wrong. Actually, a video game I like that not everybody liked was Cyberpunk 2077.
Is that the Keanu Reeves one?
Yeah. And that really could have done well with exploring transhumanism from a sort of social side of things, and because there's this whole subplot where you're investigating these people that have cyber psychosis, which is what happens when an implant that someone has in Cyberpunk 2077, as the name suggests, it's a cyberpunk universe, and people have implants to help them do their jobs or to just get around and whatever. Some people have a reaction to it which drives them mad and they start killing people. Right. And there's this whole subplot where you're investigating these cases of cyber psychosis, and you think, oh, this is going to build to something really interesting about the society and about class. Because actually it's a game that really delves into class dynamics and things like that, even though a lot of people painted it as not. Actually, there is some quite clever stuff in there. But this one story thread where they really could have explored it, it just sort of peters out at the end. And you're just like, why? Why did you not do anything with it? And you find that quite a lot with stories that do delve into transhumanism, is they never quite hit the mark because they almost are either afraid to go that final step or they get distracted by something else. And here, I think it's a little bit of both.
They get distracted by Jude Law putting himself in the oven at the end.
yeah, exactly. exactly. But yeah, I think there was a lot more to explore here, and maybe that's what the Gattaca TV series would have been, which was announced to be under development and then immediately wasn't.
When was that?
In 2023.
Oh, okay. It's just another example of them just like combing through every single bit of content ever for something they can rehash.
Yeah, I assume they looked at Gattaca and thought, oh yeah, this is a cult classic. And then they looked at how little it made at the box office and thought, did enough people like this? And then they looked at the content and thought, we can't build any explosions into this. And oh dear, if we actually have to explore this, we might have to talk about things like racism and ableism. We probably don't want to do that. And then they just dropped it. That's what I assume happened behind the scenes at whoever was working on it, Sony or whoever. But yeah, it's it's a shame. I think a TV series of Gattaca could be something very interesting.
Absolutely. That, I think, is actually the perfect medium to explore all of these things that we've been talking about, all of the kind of unanswered questions you'd have about the world of this film.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. 100%. But 'tis not to be. Maybe one day we'll get Gattaca 2.
Yeah, Big Boys Productions.
Yeah, we'll get it underway.
Gattaca 2, Jetpacks on Titan.
A fun thing for you, Danny DeVito produced this movie.
I know, I saw that on the credits.
How great
so
is that?
What? That's really cool.
He does cool shit, Danny DeVito.
Surely somewhere there's a DVD with his commentary on it.
Oh man, I would love Danny DeVito's commentary.
Gotta find it.
Danny DeVito's commentary of Gattaca would be amazing. I'd love to know his thoughts on it. But yeah, he's done a lot of production over the years, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Gets involved in a lot of TV stuff, I think, these days. But back in the day, he sort of produced other bits and bobs. Wasn't he an executive producer or a producer on Garden State, for instance?
Yeah, he's got a lot of executive producer credits.
We won't hold against him for that.
By me, he's nearly 80.
Yeah.
He's going to be 80 this year.
I wish he'd do more directing.
Yeah.
Death to Smoochie. What a movie. Matilda. Just, yeah. I'd love him to go back to directing again.
Yeah. I'm looking at his filmography now. 1986, My Little Pony, the movie. Grundle King. I don't know what that is, but he did the voice.
Amazing. Apparently, what is this? Danny DeVito directed an apocalyptic horror thriller back around 2011-2012, but was never released.
What?
That's been just sitting in limbo, apparently. What? This is amazing. I'm looking at it now. It had William Fichtner and Lance Reddick in it.
Okay.
Oh, man. This would have been... Oh, what happened to this movie? Why did this never get released? Someone... Yeah, post-production was completed in 2012.
Blimey.
Someone leak that. That's got to be sitting around somewhere. Someone leak Saint Sebastian by Danny DeVito. Oh, I'm annoyed now. I want to see the Danny DeVito horror movie.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, have you got anything else you want to say about Gattaca?
No, I think that's it. I just wanted to say, did you notice that some of the announcements were in Esperanto?
Yes, that was cool, wasn't it?
Well, isn't it? I recently became interested in Esperanto because I watched this 80s anime film called Night on the Galactic Railroad. You ever heard of that?
No, I don't know that.
It's based on a Japanese novel. It's all kind of cosmic, like kid going on this sort of magical cosmic journey in the middle of the night thing. But for some reason in the film, they decided to make them all cats. And it's like,
right.
Weirdly, the vibe is similar to Gattaca. It's really, really odd. It's nothing like it story-wise or anything. I think we should watch it together sometime. It is actually kind of about love in a way, but more like friendship, platonic love. But yeah, and it has a really, really devastatingly sad ending. But yeah, it's a really, really amazing anime film that I stumbled across, and it had a bunch of titles in Esperanto, weirdly. And I was like, what the hell is that? And then I sort of started reading about it a bit more, but, yeah, very, very interesting sort of manufactured language. And they chose to use it for the, announcements in Gattaca.
It is interesting, isn't it? So Esperanto, they started being made in the late 1800s, late 19th century, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Was seen as this sort of attempt to create this universal language. And what's interesting is there's like a really small population who still have it as one of their native speaking languages.
Yeah.
Which is just fascinating that you've got people who still have this fluency of Esperanto, but I wonder how long that's going to last. It's not something you hear about very much anymore, Esperanto, is it?
No, not at all.
Come on, bring back Esperanto.
We can do, when we do the Gattaca TV series, it could be all in Esperanto.
Yeah, put it all in. We'll get some, We'll get some Esperanto experts in and translate everything.
It's on Duolingo apparently.
Oh, I should take up learning Esperanto. That's definitely a skill that will come in handy.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're looking for a weird but interesting and quite philosophical and aesthetically sort of weirdly vibe similar to Gattaca anime film, Night on the Galactic Railroad, I highly recommend it.
I love the name alone, so I mean that's kind of sold me already.
Yeah. It looks like it's about cute cats, but it's not.
But it's not. Those cats are bastards.
Yeah, they're the worst, honestly. But no, I think that's everything I had to say. Did you have any other trivia?
No, I think we've covered it all, really, what I was going to say. The only thing to bring up is that as part of the movie's marketing campaign, there were adverts for people to call to have their children genetically engineered, and apparently thousands of people called those adverts.
Oh, really?
Wow. Children at Gattigan.
See, that's good marketing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, how did it then just flop at the box office? I guess that's not marketing for the film, isn't it?
I guess
didn't connect that with the film.
People were just annoyed that, like, I called up to get my kid genetically engineered. Wanted to give him bat wings. But yeah. No. Never heard back from this Gattaca company. But yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's it from me. So how are we going to rate this?
Let's see. How many times a day do you need to inject someone else's blood into you to be the Superman?
I inject myself with Jude Law's blood 17 times a day.
Yeah, I will agree with that. Honestly, it's a very, very good film if you've never seen it. Oh,
yeah, go find it. Go find it on Amazon Prime, apparently, not on ITVX.
Or on ITVX if you want to watch it with a bunch of really irritating ads.
Every like 15 minutes, a bunch of ads turning up. Yeah, it's very annoying. But yeah, there's a great film. What have we got next?
You remember a few episodes ago we were talking about Zac Efron, and he had this film coming out where like John Cena plays their made up friend. It's come out on Amazon Prime. It's called Ricky Stanicky. But now I thought the concept was very good. But now having seen the poster, I'm a bit doubtful. But I think we should check it out.
What's it called? Ricky Stanicky.
It's on Amazon Prime, and it's out now. So I figure we should pivot and discuss something new.
Okay, I'm loving this poster. John Cena's wearing a Britney Spears "Baby One More Time" outfit. Lots of people standing around awkwardly. Yeah, all right. Let's go with this. This looks like it could either be extremely funny or absolute trash, and either way, I'm on board.
It's directed by Peter Farrelly, so I'm not expecting much on that front. But it's a good premise. It's the name of an imaginary character invented by three longtime friends as someone to blame for their misbehavior. So I like that concept.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's go for it.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for tuning in. We really appreciate it. If you haven't seen Gattaca, go check it out. If you have, watch it again. Why not? You can find us on Twitter at BigBoysDon'tPod. You can email us BigBoysDon'tCryPodcast@gmail.com. We'll be back next week to talk about Ricky Stanicky. I try to remember the name.
Ricky Stanicky.
Yeah. Oh no, that's right. It was a link to. It was supposedly going to be directed by Steve Odekirk, but then that didn't happen. That was the link we were talking about as well, right? So no, then it got passed over to Peter Farrelly. Okay. Let's see. Well, that should be good.
Lovely. Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Bye.